Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The environmentalist Bill McKibben pulls no punches. He argues life on Earth as our parents and grandparents knew it no longer exists. We've pumped too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that's resulted in a planet that's melting, drying, acidifying, flooding, and burning. It sounds apocalyptic, but McKibben says there is a way to survive in this brave new world. And joining me now to talk about climate change and a fundamental shift in how we live our lives is Bill McKibben. He's a writer, an environmentalist, and president and co-founder of 350.org, an international climate change campaign. He's the author of 14 books, including The End of Nature, The Age of Information, and most recently, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. And Bill McKibben joins me in studio. Bill, thanks very much for your time today.
Jennifer, what a pleasure to be with you.
Later on in the program, we'll talk about a new play that examines race in America through the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. But first, rethinking civilization. How has global warming changed the way you live, you recreate, you consume? Do you think individual actions like composting and buying local can really help humans survive climate change? If you have questions or comments for Bill McKibben, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Bill McKibben, you wrote the book The End of Nature in 1989. It's clearly tinged with sadness about the predictions of our warming climate. And 20 years later, you wrote your latest book, Earth, and you write that that sadness has turned into a sharper-edged fear. Talk about that transition between sadness and fear.
So in 1989, you know, The End of Nature was the first book about climate change for a general audience. And at the time, we thought that this would take a while to play out. The only place where scientists were wrong was in being too conservative, in underestimating just how quickly and how hard this would pinch. And I called this last book Earth, spelled funny, E-A-A-R-T-H. You kind of have to channel your inner Schwarzenegger to pronounce it. Earth. Because, you know, look, same number of continents, gravity still applies, but it's a different place. The world's oceans are 30% more acid than they were 40 years ago. There's about 40% less ice in the summer Arctic. Most amazing, really, most portentous is the changes in hydrology around this planet. Here's the thing you want to remember if you want to understand how the 21st century is unfolding. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. We've raised the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree, burning coal and gas and oil, and that's raised the humidity, the moistness of the atmosphere, about 4%. That's an enormous change in a baseline physical phenomenon. It loads the dice for drought and for flood. And we're seeing both of those around the world and close to home with extraordinary frequency now. Last year saw the most multi-billion dollar weather disasters in American history. In fact, we broke the record as early as August, and it was the storm that just about wiped out my home state of Vermont, the aftermath of Tropical Storm Irene, that was the record breaker. This kind of stuff now happens someplace around the world almost every day, and the toll it's taking is enormous. And the real problem is, unless we break our addiction to coal and gas and oil soon, that 1 degree, the climatologists tell us, will be 4 or 5 degrees before the century is out. And then, you know, just Katie bar the door. All bets are off. There's no reason to think we can even start to deal with change like that.
You mentioned some of the issues that you have seen that scientists are documenting. I mean, it's hard science now. Sea levels are rising. There's more melting of glaciers. And yet the Earth is actually drying out.
Well, dry places are getting dry and drier, and wet places are getting wetter. So, I mean, think about last year in this country. Texas and Oklahoma were locked in a drought worse than the Dust Bowl years. Both of them set new records for the hottest summers ever recorded by any state in the Union. Meanwhile, 500 miles east, the Mississippi and the Missouri were taking record volumes of water. We were having to blow up levees to save cities. Because they had record rainfall. Look at what's going on across, you know, the Mountain West. We have years with extraordinarily deep snowpack because, I mean, record rainfall when it's below 32 degrees is called record snowfall. And then we have years with very scant snow, and those are becoming more and more common as snowpack diminishes. Look at other effects we see here. Think about the pine bark beetle, liberated by year after year of not very cold winters to spread like crazy and wipe out, you know, millions of acres now of pine trees across the West. These kind of changes are happening everywhere. It's hard for us. We see each one of them, but because our view of the world is not very global, we tend not to really notice them. That's why 350.org on the 5th of May will sponsor this big day we're calling Connect the Dots. And all over the world, you know, people in Thailand who dealt with devastating flooding last November, people in Melbourne, Australia, who lost 200 people in the worst wildfires ever the year before that, people in Kenya who can't afford to eat anymore because the price of corn and wheat has gone through the roof from failed harvests, people in Texas, people in Utah, people in Vermont, all will be rallying in place and trying to help us connect those dots, understand this pattern. People are getting it. There was a study out yesterday indicating that the number of Americans who understand that global warming is real and serious rose 6 or 7% last year alone, and that this extreme weather was the biggest cause for that rise. So people are starting to make those connections.
As the earth changes, the weather patterns change, you also note that life is changing. You mentioned the beetles, but one aspect that I found very interesting was jellyfish. What's happening with the jellyfish?
Good. It's a boom market in jellyfish. If you can buy jellyfish futures, you know, go for it. you know, as the oceans collapse, jellyfish will be one of the big winners. We're losing all kinds of other sea life because as seawater absorbs carbon from the atmosphere, it becomes more acid. The ocean's about 30% more acid. That makes life difficult for anything that has to form a shell. The calcium chemistry of the ocean changes, and it becomes, in fact, shells at a certain point on the tiny cellular shelled creatures begin to erode. And with all that out of the way, jellyfish begin to explode. So this is, you know, there are a few things that if you really like, global warming will be a treat. Mosquitoes are the other one. They really love the warm, wet world that we're constructing on their behalf.
It's a pretty bleak picture that you're painting, to be honest, Bill McKibben. I think that, you know, it's a chain reaction. You talk about drawing attention to the connections that we're seeing. But this domino effect can really put a pit in your stomach.
Absolutely. And there's no getting around it. And one should be worried, scared. The good news is it doesn't need to happen. We know what we need to do to get off coal and gas and oil. And increasingly, we have the technology that makes it possible. What we lack is the political will to do anything about it. And the reason we lack that political will, frankly, is because the financial power of the fossil fuel industry has been great enough that they've been able to warp our politics. We see this time and again. So we spent much of the year fighting this Keystone pipeline from the tar sands of Canada. And out in public, in open, we, you know, won all the debates. We had, when it got to Congress, the House of Representatives took a vote to speed up this pipeline, and they voted 234 of them to speed it up. And those 234 members had taken $42 million from the fossil fuel industry. Now, you know, I know that this is sort of how things work in Washington, but it's not right. It's, you know, it would be outrageous if someone found out that, you know, BYU was paying off the referees before the football game. You know, not even BYU fans would be happy about it. Everybody would be outraged. That's not how it, well, that's what goes on in our Congress. These guys take money from companies and then vote on their interests.
Bill McKibben, he's a writer, an environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. an international climate change campaign. He'll be speaking as part of the 7th annual J. Bonner Ritchie Dialogue on Peace and Justice at Utah Valley University later this afternoon. I'll give you details on that in a bit. But if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. So political will, it may be lacking in some quarters. What in the world gives you a kernel of hope? I mean, how do you remain optimism?
So that's a good question.
In the face of this,
some days
calamity.
I don't remain optimistic. Okay, there are days when I'm just, you know. But on the other hand, I've got children, so I have no choice, really, right? Here's what makes me optimistic. We founded this group, 350.org, 4 years ago. When we founded it, it was myself and 7 undergraduates at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I teach. We had no money. We had those 7 students. So 7, good number, because there are 7 continents. Each one of them took one, okay? We went to work from that inauspicious beginning, and we've now, I think, coordinated 15,000 rallies in every country on Earth except North Korea. It's become what CNN called the most widespread political activity in the planet's history. There are lots of people, Jennifer, who really want to go to work on these issues, who understand that the future is at stake in a way that it's never been at stake before. And so we're building that movement. Now, I don't know whether we got started in time. There are scientists who say that some of this, clearly some of it, is irreversible. There are political scientists who say the odds are simply too high. There's too much money on the other side. But we're not, since we can't compete in money terms, we're never going to have as much money as Exxon. We got to figure out other currencies, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes we have to spend our bodies, you know. 1,253 of us went to jail in Washington in the summer, this peaceful civil disobedience that was the largest civil disobedience action in about 30 years in this country. You know, we get to work with interesting and great young people like the people at Peaceful Uprising here in Utah, or, you know, people all over the country and all over the world, all religious groups, all, most of the people we work with, of course, are poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the world is made up of, you know, and those are the people in many cases for whom the future is bearing down the hardest right now. So they're the ones who are first to rally.
Bill McKibben, the writer, the environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. He's speaking today as part of the 7th annual J. Bonner Ritchie Dialogue on Peace and Justice at Utah Valley University. It's sponsored by the Peace and Justice Studies program, and that's happening this afternoon at 2:30 in the Reagan Theater at Utah Valley University. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments about climate change or about changing the way we look at how climate change will affect us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Over 20 years ago, author and environmentalist Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature, the first mainstream work to red flag climate change. He continues to push for reducing carbon emissions and moving beyond fossil fuels through the grassroots campaign 350.org and in his latest book, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. He's speaking this afternoon at Utah Valley University. We'll give you details on that in just a bit. But you can join our conversation if you like. How do you envision life on a changed Earth? Do you think McKibben's idea to replace our growth-based way of life and concentrate on less and local is realistic? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Bill McKibben, before the break, you mentioned peaceful movement and going to jail and being willing to put yourself out there as an activist. In The End of Nature, you write about the ecotage immortalized by Edward Abbey and monkey wrenching. And I'm wondering if you think monkey wrenching is sort of the way to go. I mean, if we're going to have to get to that point.
No, I mean, I must say Abbey was a friend of mine and one of my favorite writers there ever was. But I think even when he was writing about it, he was, you know, not, I mean, he was a novelist. He was, I don't think going out and spiking trees and things actually accomplish as much at this point. I do think that being willing to do work in the tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience sometimes is necessary. It's one of the many things that activists can do. Not the only one, but there are times when, you know, one has to draw attention to the moral urgency of questions. Maybe it's because I'm a Sunday school teacher. I take some of those moral questions very much to heart, and I must say, I'd never spent the night in jail before. There was, scary though it was, to be in Central Cell Block in D.C., which is as much fun as it sounds like it might be. There was a certain kind of peaceful feeling too, you know, that I was sort of where I belonged for a little while. And in this case, the civil disobedience was quite effective. It took a pipeline that no one had heard about and made it a national issue. The president denied the permit. The Senate is going to vote today on whether to override the president on this question or not. We'll see. But that was how it got started as a big public issue. And so the brave people who came to Washington, including a number from Utah, a number from all 50 states, they did a good thing. What was interesting about that demonstration was we said, if you want to come get arrested, we need you to be wearing your Sunday best. And everybody did. You know, everybody was in coat and tie or wearing a dress. And the reason was we wanted a visual way to say something I think is important, which is that in this struggle, we are not the radicals or the militants. We're hoping that we can have a planet something like the one we were born on, too. Radicals work at oil and coal and gas companies. They are willing to alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere in order to make money. They're doing, you know, if you were writing the new Bond film, that's what you'd have, the give me $10 trillion or I will alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere. You know, that's in essence what the CEOs of our big oil companies say every day of the year.
Bill McKibben, the author and environmentalist, speaking today at Utah Valley University. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Well, let's go to the phones. Heidi's joining us from Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Good morning, and thank you so much for all of your good work, Bill. You're a big hero of mine. My question is, there are so many climate deniers still, and especially in this country. It seems like this country is the big nut to crack because we are the ones that are some of the biggest polluters and the biggest contributors to climate change. But yet, such a large percentage of this country still are in denial, and a lot of them religious people. I wonder what is the best argument that other religious groups are having to persuade religious groups that it is up to us. It's not God that's going to save us.
How do you convince the religious folk that climate change is real?
Well, as I say, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher myself, so these are things I think about and think are very important. And we've had the good luck of working with religious groups of all kinds all over the world. I'll never forget before our first big global day of action when the patriarch of the Orthodox Church, leader of 400 million Eastern Christians, gave a sermon in which he said global warming is a sin and 350 is an act of redemption. That was powerful. It helped our organizing across much of Europe, I'll tell you that. What religious groups usually focus on are two things. One, the need to carefully steward creation. If you believe that this world we live in was created for us, then you acquire a special burden, a burden put on us in the beginning of Genesis to keep and dress the garden, to exercise careful dominion over this planet, which we're clearly not doing at the moment since we're raising its temperature and driving species to extinction and changing the chemistry of the ocean. The other argument that religious people often make, and I think exactly appropriately, is that this is a key issue towards living out those gospel calls for loving one's neighbor. If our actions, our economies, are spreading dengue fever through Asia, if they're causing flooding that drives 20 million people in Pakistan out of their homes, if they're, in all those ways, we're not loving our neighbors. We're drowning them, we're burning them out, we're making it hard for them to have enough to eat, we're making them sick, and hence getting our desires under control so that we don't do that anymore becomes a very powerful moral action. And I think this is one reason that many religious groups, including a huge part of the evangelical movement, the younger part of it, is now joining in this fight. I don't think we're probably ever, I wouldn't spend my time trying to convince the hardest to convince deniers about climate change. Their opposition is usually rooted in ideology, and they're often of an age that makes it difficult for them to change. But young people of all stripes who are going to be on this planet for another 50, 60, 70 years are increasingly realizing that it's very much up to them to make sure that the planet will work for their lifetimes and then for all, as they say in the Bible, yea unto the generations, all those that will follow afterwards.
Heidi, how important do you think it is to harness religious groups and faith traditions in a climate change campaign?
Well, I've been wondering that for a while, and it's like, how do we get through to people? But I think Bill's right. We target those that are willing to rethink things, that they don't need to be the way that they've been, that we can change the trajectory that we're going on so that we who profess to, which is all of us, who profess to love our children and our grandchildren, we need to rethink things and we need to change our ways and start living sustainably.
I'll tell you two interesting, well, here's a particularly interesting thing that I've noticed about religious people in this country. Not just the LDS Church, many, many religious organizations are among the biggest promoters of overseas travel, you know. People go on mission trips, short and long, of all kinds, from all kinds of faith groups. And even though their main point is not necessarily to be looking at, you know, what's going on scientifically in some particular place, you can't help but notice that people are dealing with new traumas all the time as temperatures rise, as sea levels rise, as coral reefs die, all of that. And as people get back here, and of course most of those people tend to be younger, they're turning up the political heat, so I'm saying we've really got to begin to take seriously these things.
Heidi, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're speaking with Bill McKibben, the activist, environmentalist, and author. You, in End of Nature, you predict that genetic engineering could be the key to our survival. I'm wondering, you know, 20 years after the fact, do you have the optimism that genetic engineering can change the way that, you know, can
no,
save our species?
We've seen very little progress from genetic engineering, say, in terms of food, which is where people had hoped that we'd develop a lot of drought-tolerant and heat-tolerant crops and things. That's not been happening. The genetic engineering companies have been spending their time developing crops that resist their particular brand of pesticide so they can sell more of them. It's been And there's no way that we'll be able to engineer our way around a 4 or 5 degree increase in temperature. Mm-hmm. We've got to stop that. The latest data from the University of Washington and Stanford shows that from this point on, each degree increase in global average temperature should lead to about a 10% decline in grain yields. Okay, you know, you do the math in your head. Try to imagine this planet with 20 or 30% fewer calories because we've raised the temperature 2 or 3 degrees.
So how do you stop the bleeding? I guess that's the question. You talk about efficiency, conservation, buying local.
Here's the political. I mean, everybody who's ever studied this, all the economists, all the policy people come to the same thing. We got to put a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. And when we do that, when we stop letting the fossil fuel industry be the only industry that gets to throw out its waste for free, then we'll get serious about making the speedy transition to renewable energy that's possible. That's a political fight. The fossil fuel industry, which is making record profits, I mean literally, Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money, okay? As long as they're doing that, and as long as our democracy allows people, in essence, to purchase congressmen, then it's going to be a very, very difficult fight. That's the fight that we're engaged in, and it's the fight that will tell whether or not we have some kind of future. All the things we can do locally and in our communities are very good and very important. And they allow us to imagine a future that we might be able to make work if we can staunch the flow of carbon into the atmosphere. But they want, you can have the best local food system on Earth, you know, and if it doesn't rain for 30 days, or if it rains every day for 30 days, then you're still not growing anything. So we've got to have this political battle, and it's got to come out right. It's the most important battle people have ever had to fight, I think.
We're speaking with Bill McKibben, the writer, the environmentalist. He's speaking at Utah Valley University this afternoon at 2:30. Before we go, though, I want to sneak in one more phone call. This is Rolly from Salt Lake City. Rolly, hi.
Hi. Thank you for doing this program. It's really important, I believe. I'm a little emotional about this, a little, you know, it gets my blood pressure up. But planning and zoning could be a really important thing to help our Western lifestyles be less consumptious. For instance, we wouldn't have to get in the car to do absolutely anything we do away from our homes. And then planning and zoning in terms of making sure people build passive solar structures. Passive solar structures have been around since the cave dwellings. They built them on south-facing overhangs, and they had cool in the summer and warm in the winter. It works. Since the beginning of Earth Day, we've been hearing it's 20 years before they can give us solar and electric solar, and it's all been here. If we do it ourselves, for ourselves, it's just 20 years away for somebody to be able to sell us energy. You know, I have friends that built a house in Minnesota. A friend that built a house in Minnesota, his heating bill for the winter, keeping his thermostat at 72 degrees, was $26 in Minnesota.
No, Rolly's exactly right. I just finished a piece last year for National Geographic, and it was about energy in China. And it was completely fascinating to me because, of course, China's made a lot of bad energy choices. They're doing what we did. They're burning a lot of coal. But they've also done a lot of really interesting things. Here's the most significant. They've done a huge amount of solar hot water, okay? This is not complicated technology. It's not even expensive technology like solar photovoltaics are at this point. The payback time, where I live in Vermont, which is not as sunny as it is here, for a solar hot water system on your roof is 2 or 3 years, okay? But in this country, it's less than 1% of Americans who have them. In China, it's over 25%. 250 million Chinese, when they take a shower at night, the hot water's coming off the roof. It's not because we don't have the technology, and here I'll tell you a story that to demonstrate it. I spent a day with the guy who runs the biggest solar hot water company in China, Hemin Solar, Huang Ming, this engineer, nice guy. We had a nice talk. At the end of it, he said, come into my little antechamber here, my little private museum. And of course, he had all the pictures of himself shaking hands with famous people. But there in the middle of the floor was this old solar panel. He said, you know what that is? No. That was one of the solar hot water panels that Jimmy Carter put on the White House in 1979. And Ronald Reagan took down in 1985. We've known how to do this stuff for 40 years. It's high time that we actually did it. And the moment we'll really do it, as I said before, I think, is the moment when we put a price on energy that reflects the damage it's doing in the atmosphere. Then we'll all be solar really, really fast.
Mm. Rolly, thanks so much for the call. Our time is short, but I want to ask you this finally. So much of this, you say, is political will. It's changing our individual and local habits. But in a way, it's a fundamental shift in the attitude that we have toward life on Earth and this growth model, both economic and, the accumulation factor there. It just seems to me that changing a mindset is a lot harder than changing behaviors.
So let's don't worry overly about changing the mindset. Let's start by changing the ways we power our lives. And that'll have some effects. If you think about it, coal and gas and oil were perfectly designed for the kind of huge, centralized, globalized world that they've built. They're concentrated in a few places, rich in BTUs, easy to transport. Sun and wind are kind of opposite. They're everywhere, omnipresent, but diffuse. As we go to them, we will inevitably become more local in our ways of thinking. And that'll be good for a thousand other things, Jennifer, including the fact that we'll build stronger communities than we have now. We've allowed our communities to erode in too many ways as we became consumers above all. As we become neighbors above all again, that will be a salutary change in more ways than we have time to list if we had 4 hours here.
Bill McKibben, the writer, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. He's delivering the lecture, Earth, Making Life on a Tough New Planet, as part of the 7th Annual J. Bonner Ritchie Dialogue on Peace and Justice at Utah Valley University. That's happening this afternoon at 2:30 at UVU, and there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Bill McKibben, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we're talking about race and politics in America. A look at the new play, The Third Crossing. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.